Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bauman. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that help make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today, we're talking to Vaughn Garland. Recently, Vaughn's work was reviewed by the Art Index as one of the 10 best 2007 summer shows in New York City. Welcome, Vaughn, to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How'd it feel to read that?
It was kind of wonderful in a way.
I'm sure it was.
It was scary, but it was a group show, so it's kind of it was a great experience. So it kind of knocked me on the floor for a second.
Tell me a little bit about because I always blow this. I always do. I get halfway through the interview and nobody has any idea who I'm talking to or what their background is or anything, because we get into, you know, what their process is and what they're interested in. But tell me a little bit about your background and a little bit about what you're doing now to sort of survive.
Goodness. Basically, the background.
You can start at like the age of two.
There's probably something before then for me.
There was the diapers.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of grew up in a very religious household.
Really?
My dad was a Southern Baptist minister.
Wow.
Which is partly why I'm painting and stuff like that. And also, he was a dean of a college and a professor, and I grew up with teachers around, and also farmers, like railroad people in my household. So it's
really?
Kind of a...
So it's this incredible mixture of religion, education, intellect, and down-to-earth folks.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a great experience, and something that really works into my work now. But I'm a painter, and I kind of just... I never really knew it until I got in college, and so...
Really?
I had no art.
Really? None.
Well, I actually in high school I made this little like Christmas sleigh out of toothpicks.
Uh-huh. Right.
And that was only art that I had up until high school, and then in college I kind of
Christmas sleigh out of toothpicks.
Yeah,
that's
it was
telling
horrible.
Kind of.
It was horrible.
A little prickly, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But yeah, I had no training and then just kind of stumbled on it and then just fell in love with it.
Stumbled on it at VCU.
No, actually, I went to liberal arts college in Emory, Virginia, called Emory and Henry College.
Right.
And kind of made my, like, I was, you know, a teenager at the time and just starting college, and so I made my way into college trying to think about being an engineer. And
really?
That failed quickly. And then I moved into English, which I kind of loved for a long time. And took an art history class, and then fell in love with art, and then took a painting class, and as soon as I held a brush, I knew.
Really?
It was kind of really, it was really odd, but I guess I'm kind of a son of education and religion combined in a way. So.
Yeah. When that moment when you picked up a brush, is that anything you can ever talk about? I kind of asked people about that. Was there, is it just totally an intuitive...
I've tried to explain to my students this, because I have a lot of questions from people that come in and they're freshmen and they're not sure what they want to do, and I, you know, like I said, I was the same way, and so I try to explain it in the best possible way I can, but it's kind of for me picking up that brush. You know, everything that I had in the past and everything I could have talked about in the past just kind of came through.
Really?
And it gave me a way to talk about religion and talk about, you know, politics, what I was really, really interested in, and talking about, you know, all the...
How does, because hopefully some of the people listening are at where you were at then, right?
Yeah.
All right. So how does a paintbrush talk about religion, talk about politics, talk about, not the paintbrush itself, but I mean the artist using the paintbrush, but how does that happen?
Well, I think for me it was a way of getting... these things in my head actually down. I wrote all the time, but it wasn't actually using a paintbrush and creating it was a way for me to go through the process and kind of clean my head of these things.
Were these like ideas? Were these emotions? Were these perceptions? Were these reflections of
It was mostly grand narratives in a way. It was
really?
These huge kind of stories about, you know, I grew up in like I said, the Southern Baptist Church, so there was always like this good and bad,
yeah,
you know, constantly. And so that was a way for me to deal with the paint itself, because, you know, you've got the paint and you've got the brush there, and you can kind of combine those two and deal with those good and bad automatically.
Mm-hmm.
You can wipe away, you know, if need be. So it was a way for me to kind of push through those and then put them down on a space.
I mean, is religion a big part of your work?
Spirituality in a way, yeah. But it's kind of going back to the idea of good and bad. It that plays in very, very much.
How so?
Because let's see.
And remember, we only have 30 minutes. So.
Exactly. Exactly. I think this is more like a 4-day
conversation.
Lecture in a way.
Right. Let's see, good and bad, 5 minutes. Okay, you got good, that's white, bad, that's black.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right. No, it, like, I could talk about...
I mean, can you talk about some piece of work where you've struggled with that?
Yeah, well, the largest piece I did in grad school was called Sisyphus.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And that's part of my English
that's
on a literature
pretty
coming in.
Grand scale. Yeah, right. For those of you who don't know about Sisyphus, he was doomed to roll a rock up the side of a hill, and of course never made it to the top, and the rock would roll back down again. He'd have to go back to try again. So it was sort of the absolute definition of frustration.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was perfect for that painting too. Mm-hmm. And this painting was actually kind of the largest painting I did. It was 8x12 feet long.
Wow.
So it's kind of this huge space.
Sort of a Sisyphusian kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I started using these layers to, I would actually paint with a lot of different colors, and that was the good part of it. And then I would start taking away all those colors by covering it in a black,
right,
or a white. So
right.
I was actually kind of dealing with the good and the bad and letting things kind of come through the painting.
Mm-hmm.
So with Sisyphus, you know, there's 3 inches of paint on one side of the painting. It's just
no
so
kidding.
Much paint.
Really?
It's
3 inches thick.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Actually, it was I put it up
kind
in
of
a,
expensive too.
Yeah, yeah. And what's more expensive? I have a storage unit just for that painting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Basically,
I talked to a guy one time who used to make big paintings, and I said, he's older now, and I said, so how come you don't make big paintings anymore? And he said, he just looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, because I don't have any place to put them anymore.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now he makes like these little, like, you know, like 1 foot by 1 foot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I did that too. And actually, I'd love to just tear those things down and make a boat out of them.
Really? Like, a canvas boat, no less.
Exactly.
A kayak, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
A Sisyphusian kayak.
Yeah.
And then you could paddle across the Atlantic, which would be a Sisyphusian task. So
yeah.
It would all
if,
work out.
If I get past the James, that would probably be good.
Yeah. So, but the good and the bad. So you were struggling with those in terms of color, in terms of surface, in terms of the struggle between the color, the black, the color. I don't understand.
It's a combination of all of those. I mean, it's you know, one lesson I had when I was in college was never use white, never use straight white in a painting. So just that idea of a color,
mm-hmm,
to never use or to use.
Right.
I kind of go against those ideas in a way.
Right. I was going to say to an artist, never use white. You know,
yeah.
It's like, okay, now how much white can I use?
Exactly. Like, and this is why I can use this.
Right.
So, you know, color goes along with it. And you know, I guess when I got into grad school, I was doing these very narrative, figurative kind of paintings in a way.
Uh-huh.
Landscapes, you know, I had, you know, figure of a female beside the figure of a male with a chair, and there's so much narrative in my head.
Yeah.
And it took me a while with some help from the professors there to get rid of that and actually go into abstraction, which is kind of a great story. But that abstraction was allowed me to deal with the positive and
the
negative.
Talk about
better.
That a little bit. Because I think a lot of people look at figurative work or basically, you know, a painting of images, and they look at abstract work. And I was thinking about calling this show. I've said this a million times. Thinking about calling this show. Well, I could have done that,
mm-hmm,
right? Because people walk in museums, see an abstract painting, and go, well,
yeah,
I could have done that.
Yeah.
But they look at a figurative painting And if it has draftsmanship skills, they go, wow, that's really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, enormously dated, but still very prevalent.
Yeah.
So talk about that transition for you from doing these figurative representational kinds of things to that I could have done that kind of work.
It was, you know, it was difficult for me to actually make that, like, that change. I've had the same comments before, and I was actually one of those people when I first started out. You know, I was looking at a lot of the old great masters, and you know, Michelangelo and Leonardo and Raphael and all those painters, and they seemed like magical kind of people with a brush, and I was kind of against the idea of painting abstractly, because at first I as a student felt that people that painted in an abstract manner didn't know how to paint realistically, so they just, it was easier, you know.
It was so easier. Exactly.
That was my whole idea of it. And the more that I learned that there was a difference between trying to paint in that realistic term and trying to get this narrative out, you know, I figured out that the idea of painting was me physically painting was my story, was the way I made stuff, was stuff, how I combined things. So getting rid of that narrative and getting rid of that chair that was in the painting was a way for me just to deal with, you know, this is my story. My brush and the paint in front of me is my story. But it got into a couple of heated conversation with professors in grad school. I went to the National one day. I was very upset and kind of wanted to get away from Richmond and you know, out of the studio, and went to the National, and I kind of just stepped in front of a Robert Motherwell painting. Exactly.
For those of you who don't know, we're talking lots of black and white.
And it was
as a matter of fact, that's about it.
I think this one was called Plato's Cave in the National.
Right.
And it just hit me. You know, I understood, like, and maybe I, you know, it's my interpretation, but I understood the marks that he was making and why he was trying to make those marks to describe Plato's Cave. So at that moment, I came home and started. I just completely switched and started.
How did you? Well, Plato's Cave is that the one where Plato is, somebody lives in a cave, and all they ever perceive are the shadows that are coming in through the cave.
Yeah.
All right. And so go ahead.
Well, there's, for Plato's Cave, basically there is a fire on one side of the cave. Mm-hmm. There's a wall in the middle of the fire, and the person's on, say, the left side, and the fire's on the right side. Basically, the person cannot see. They're not looking towards the fire. They're looking at the wall.
Right.
And in the actual story of the cave, these images, or these people would walk images across the wall, which would reflect on
the shadow on the wall.
Shadow on the wall. And so, basically, these people were kind of chained there. So they were. This one person broke loose and left the cave and actually were able to see, you know, like the image of a chair outside, or, you know, not a chair, but the image of, you know, a tree outside instead of having the shadow. So that whole idea of removing that, like, that magic trick in a way, and just seeing the real life object, you know.
So this was almost the reverse.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
What Motherwell had done was going back to the cave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, in a way, but at the same time, like with the abstraction, is I think that he also, you know, dealt with, like, the stuff that I dealt with too, and I, you know, might be completely wrong in this, but this is my own interpretation. But he dealt with the idea of just painting and not having to rely on you know, the figure or you know, some sort of story. You know, it's more about, like, the act of painting.
Right.
That was important. So,
which has been a real transition over the last 100 years, I guess.
Yes.
From very realistic work to the process becoming about what you just said about the painting. So, let me read something to you and see if you can make any sense of this, okay? Because this often happens in the art world to people who aren't initiated. This is by Donald Cuspid, and for those of you who don't know who Donald Cuspid is, he is an art historian and, I guess, an art reviewer, is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah.
Who's highly esteemed around the world. And it says here, Vaughan Garland makes stunning black paintings, fusing gestualism, a wide range of surfaces, some thickly applied, some striped thin, with the post-painterly abstraction of Barnett Newman. It is a postmodern synthesis. Newman zips, sometimes brightly colored, forms interior boundaries in Garland's black field, making for a striking contrast. The zips seem lyrical and the black epic and the overwhelming and a bit off-putting and overbearing, but as Erica's Vim, 2002, makes clear, there is a vigor to Garland's work which seems to overcome the gravity of the black, however much it emerges from it. Okay, so...
Yeah, that's Donald Cosper for you.
So you want to put that in English for us?
Yeah, I mean, basically he was looking at the large black pieces when I was in grad school, and at that moment there were these separations in spaces, and that actually kind of goes back to the idea of being on a farm for me.
Really?
Of how some, you know, 1 acre's corn, another acre's, you know, so there's definite separations of. You know, square, uh-huh. rectangle, yeah. all that kind of stuff. Where in my work, they're integrated into the actual pieces. But at the same time, like there's an overlapping of those spaces. Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of the large black pieces, is there are maybe this huge triangle or a huge rectangle in the top corner, and these small little zips that's breaking up the other spaces. And
zips
like as a kind of well, sometimes I actually would scratch away all the paint and leave this straight mark in a way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and actually, one of the pieces that he talked about further was this piece called Id, and it was a large black painting, a lot of different little spaces, but then at the very kind of a third down from the top, I took this bright blue streak and put mm-hmm. it extreme, like very mm-hmm. precisely across the whole painting, so it broke up that space. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what he's talking about, how Barnett Newman
right.
used the same sort right. of zip in a way to break up the space. And it was more, you know, the idea of having this color beside each other.
So is there a narrative going on at all?
Yeah, definitely.
There is?
Yes.
What is it?
For me, it goes back to that. You know, I guess I have problems and trouble believing in a truth in a way. Mm-hmm. And so for me to break up the space and even erase away something right. is the narrative for me. It's trying to describe like how I piece together things. And in this sense, basically, like I said, it dealt a lot with
How do you think, but how does the viewer, do you think that it's important for the viewer to come to your work with a fair amount of sophistication?
No, I don't think so.
No, really?
No. No, I think that the viewer can come to the work and basically, hopefully travel around the work and get something out for themselves. I don't expect the viewer to understand all these things. These things are just for me.
They are for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't at all okay. expect, you know,
okay. somebody.
Okay,
and that's really an important distinction, I think.
Yeah.
Between, you know, representational work where it's sort of, you know, because we're so visual in our world, especially now with all the images we're bombarded with, mm-hmm. you know, people can look at representational work and go, okay, it's good, it's bad, I like it, I don't like it. But abstract work they struggle with,
mm-hmm.
and or some do. I mean, I've been in shows. I was in Sally was having a show, and some guy came in off the street. He was a carpenter, and he said, "Well, you know, man, I've never been to one of these things before. But like, you know, I was like kind of thirsty, so I thought I'd get some wine."
Yeah.
And he was looking at Sally's painting, and he was blown away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he said, "That's really." He said, "Well, I know I'm like a carpenter, but he said she had painted on wood. He said mm-hmm. the wood grain on there and the way that color." Mm-hmm. It gets that wood grain,
yeah.
you know, and he was just having this amazing experience
yeah,
that
exactly.
he'd never had before, ever had before.
Yeah.
He said, "Man, I didn't know I liked art." He said, "This is really beautiful."
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
it's
great, and you know, yeah. it's something that can happen all the time and does happen a lot. You know, mm-hmm. And I think that the newer paintings are much more direct than those. You know, the black pieces and the white pieces. I knew that even making them that, you know, they were very. Separated from realism.
Yeah, so but somebody like a cuspid could look at it and get it right away, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he knew exactly
yeah.
what you were up to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. But the new pieces that I'm working on are much more, I mean, they're abstract, but I think that they're much more acceptable to people that know, to individuals that don't have a background in art.
Right. Yeah. What's the, not the word acceptable, but just sort of. Yeah, what is the word? You know, not obtainable, but it's that word in between those
exactly,
two.
Exactly,
exactly. So, someone quick call in and tell us. Accessible. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Which is tricky because, you know, do you want to make it for them or do you want to make it for yourself? And do you struggle with that? Do you struggle with, or are you just very happy making what you want to make the way you want to make it in your studio?
Well, I think most artists struggle with that. I mean, they want to be accepted. Mm-hmm. You know, they want somebody to come up and say, "Oh my God, you know, right. This is amazing. I get this." You know, and of course, yeah, that's part of it in the studio. But at the same time, like it's something that I've had a time trying to get rid of, so I'm kind of enjoying it right now.
Uh-huh.
The idea of, you know, not being really understood, which is fine.
Yeah.
Because I've actually come to the fact that I'm not really understood really, like, at all. So,
right.
It's okay that the work does the same thing.
But you teach.
I teach, yeah.
Yeah, talk about that.
Oh, gosh. I love teaching. You know?
Do. I was going to say, do you like it? Yeah.
I love teaching. It's an amazing thing to do, and I love like connecting with the students and helping them, and at the same time, like, they help me. You know, mm-hmm. I come home and I'm like energized and ready to go in the studio because I dealt, you know, 4 or 5 hours straight with somebody and their work, and you know, just talking to them opens my head a little bit,
right.
So I can
right.
deal with some stuff. So. It's kind of a wonderful thing, and you know it's in my blood in a way.
Yeah,
it's there.
Well, you're very so. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a gift, you know, to be able to teach and to be able to paint.
Yeah.
You know,
it's difficult. It's difficult.
Yeah, because you were saying you were tang to toward the interdo. You were saying, see, I can edit this stuff out, but I won't. You were saying before the interview that you're teaching, how many classes? I left track.
Well, I teach one for Jay Sargent right now, and also I teach three classes for George Mason. So it's kind of, I travel up to D.C. twice a week now.
Right.
And pick up classes whenever I can, other mm-hmm. institutions like VCU or whatever, whenever
right.
they need me.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of us out there that are adjunct professors kind of,
yeah.
on the road every day, driving the, you know, mm-hmm. JMU to UVA to, you know, we're kind of everywhere. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, wave at us as you go down the street.
Well, you also mentioned something interesting about sculpture.
Yes.
You said it's sort of a hobby of yours.
Yeah, yeah. It's
I'm sure there are sculptors out there right now turning
yeah,
their radios
yeah.
off.
They're not going to talk to me now.
<That's>
no.
Hobby?
It's not. Yeah, it's
but
kinda,
I know what you mean by
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's... You know, I go into VCU, basically. The VCU, that's the program.
So you graduated from VCU?
Yeah, I graduated from the grad school.
And in painting or sculpture?
Painting.
In painting, okay.
Yeah. But also, painting and sculpture worked really well together and continues to do so. So I had a lot of classes, you know, with sculptors and likewise. So I kind of started to really look at sculpture and deal with the form of sculpture was a member at ArtSpace at some point and met up with this other artist here in town who was a photographer, which is kind of funny.
Right.
And we decided to do the sculpture invitational. So a photographer and a painter coming together to put that together an outdoor sculpture show.
That was the outdoor sculpture show that was sort of over on Southside?
Yeah,
Hall
we
Street,
did that.
Walk. Oh,
mm-hmm.
really? Okay.
Yeah, we did
great.
That. We co-founded it and co-curated it for 2 years. So
right.
it was amazing.
Who was the photographer?
Jeanine Sheffield.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. She's an amazing photographer,
mm-hmm.
An artist. You know, she also does a lot of sculptural mm-hmm. photography too. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, we put that kind of together, and since then I've just kind of been or trying to immerse myself more into that world because I love the idea of public art.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why?
Well, you know, going back to. Everything links back to that two-year-old thing.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to my upbringing, you know, it was about the community in a way. You know, being in the
mm-hmm.
church and you know yeah. on the farm and all that stuff. It was about community. It was about sharing that with everyone.
Right.
So it was kind of nice to bring that out of the studio and talk to artists and let them come out of the studio and put this stuff up outside. And at the same time, like, you know, approach the city and say, you know, here are 15, 18 artists that are working here in the city, and here's their stuff, you know. So it's kind of that idea of all forms of public coming together and looking at work and being able to talk about it.
That's great. So if people want to see your work, is there a website? Is there
Yes. VaughnGarland.com.
So it's VaughnGarland.com?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's also there's a show going on right now at Red Door that I've got a piece in.
There is?
Yeah.
Okay. And where is Red Door exactly?
Red Door Gallery is on Main Street, right past Lombardi.
And how long is the show going to be there?
It just went up a couple weeks ago, so it should be up until the end of the month.
Really? When you're working with students, this is an impossible question maybe to answer, but what's the one thing you're trying to get them to do?
Actually, it's easy for me. Just open their eyes and look. I really want them to stare at an object for as long as they can, just to look at it, just to try to see how it's formed and how it's built. Once I can get a student to do that, everything changes.
Really? Interesting. What would you say to someone who walks in and says, I could have done that?
Well, you didn't. Honestly, like, and I said that. I said that last week in class. I think it was about like
a great answer.
Yeah. I said that definitely last week in class.
Okay, you're not going to believe this, but we're out of time. I mean, this goes by so fast. I keep thinking this should be an hour-long show. Hope you guys are listening out there. So I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up. And I really, really appreciate you being here. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. What I'm doing here as I'm babbling away is I'm trying to look for my outtake here. Aha, here it is. It's not even that complicated. Okay, thank you for listening. We hope to see... Let's try that again. Okay, folks, thanks for listening. We hope to see you again for lunch on the radio next Friday at 12:30. And once again, this is Tim Bowery, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM. It's Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us.